Bonjour and welcome back to All Things Africa, a podcast covering news and events from across the continent. Today is May 3rd, 2020, and I'm your host, Chris. Welcome back once again as we discuss events across Africa. Today I'll be covering news and updates from Botswana, Liberia, Uganda, Namibia, Malawi, and finally South Africa. First up, let's talk about Botswana, where a Reuters release from Brian Benza talks about Botswana's gross domestic product shrinking by 13% in 2020 as a direct consequence of the impact of the Wuhan coronavirus or COVID-19. Botswana's finance minister, Thapelo Matshekga, said that due to travel restrictions, we see the mining sector contracting 33% in 2020, with diamond revenues falling to 6.7 billion pula from the original forecast of 20 billion pula. Of course, the impact of that is that up to 10 times a year, folks come from the diamond cutting and polishing centers around the world, including Mumbai, Antwerp, and also from China, to bid on and purchase diamonds produced in Botswana for shipment abroad. Now, those 10 annual auctions are not taking place as a consequence of the international travel bans and the lockdown currently under effect in Botswana. For its part, De Beers, who is in partnership with the government of Botswana in a venture called Debswana, producing most of the diamonds in Botswana, De Beers gets 70% of its diamond supply from Botswana, most of that coming from the Juaneng mine located in southeast Botswana. As a consequence of this severe cutback in diamond spending, the government of Botswana will see its revenue and its expenditures from the government decline this year. Total revenue were expected to be 62 billion pula, or 5 billion US dollars, before the crisis hit. Now expecting to see revenue decline to just 48 billion pula. But expenditures are expected to remain at 59 billion pula for the year, so the budget deficit, which was projected to be 2.4% for 2020, will now be 5.9%. This is not exactly an unprecedented event for Botswana. In the wake of the 2008-2009 financial crisis, people around the world stopped buying diamonds, gemstone diamonds in particular, and this had a massive impact on Botswana's revenue. Most of its foreign export earnings dried up almost overnight, since Botswana, over 50 years from independence, remains overly dependent on the mining sector for the health of its economy, and in particular for revenue to the government. So the GDP expected to shrink by 13%. That's one of the starkest declines that's being reported around the world, and not exactly shocking. In other news, earlier in the week on Monday, the 27th of April, President Masisi extended the 28-day lockdown by another week before gradual easing of restrictions will take place. On May 7th, measures will begin to be eased, and the government does expect them to be fully lifted by May 30th. Now, this is in spite of the country having tested just 6,210 of its citizens as of last week, amongst a population of over 2.2 million. Of the 22 confirmed coronavirus cases in Botswana up to this point, 21 of them were people who were asymptomatic for the virus, and one, of course, had passed away. In additional news from Botswana, the U.S. government has donated 56 million pula, or 4.65 million, to help Botswana in its fight against COVID-19. This money comes from the President's Emergency Program for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR, and the Department of Defense Overseas Humanitarian Assistance, Disaster Assistance, and Civic Aid Programs, as well as from the CDC and the U.S. Agency for International Development. This will help provide 5,000 face shields, train and deploy community health workers, train healthcare workers on infection prevention and control, strengthen the existing national surveillance system, investigate COVID-19 transmission among household members, and establish a field epidemiology laboratory training program to help build a country core of in-house folks who can investigate the virus. Moving our focus to West Africa, in a rather interesting development this week, Alexander Mentol Zina, who's 56 years old and has been living in Minnesota, was deported by the U.S. government. In 2017, he was arrested by federal agents in St. Paul for immigration violations. Now, Zina was a member of Charles Taylor's National Patriotic Front of Liberia that was involved in the 13-year civil war that left at least 200,000 civilians dead. He was also a member of the Liberian National Police and served as commander in Grand Geda County. He was ordered to be deported in May of 2019 by a court in Minnesota, but he had an appeals process and his appeal was denied in January of 2020. So finally, in the end of April 2020, Alexander Mentol Zina has been
deported to Liberia. No news on what will be happening to him in Liberia. I suspect that it may not be the most pleasant of homecomings for him in Liberia. Moving across to East Africa, taking a look at events there in Uganda, and what we see is that Vonage, an American voice over IP company that provides telephony in the United States, is working with social enterprise CTI Africa to pioneer video-linked healthcare in Uganda. The digital telehealth platform is expected to offer users faster access to higher quality healthcare. As their spokesman says, as the need for remote and virtual medical care increases, especially during these challenging times, they are happy that Vonage can provide this for them. This will enable patients to speak directly to the doctors sitting in a clinic and describe any suspicious symptoms. With the information provided, doctors can remotely diagnose patients and prescribe the appropriate treatment. Now, Uganda does not have universal health care insurance, and most patients actually pay for health care out of their pockets or get it free of charge as a consequence of donors. One of the largest donors, of course, for the healthcare sector, the largest donor in Uganda, is the United States government, which annually provides somewhere between $365 and $465 million to Uganda's healthcare sector. Without it, it would be very difficult to get much in the way of healthcare in Uganda. The program with Vonage is just the latest development for telemedicine that's taking place. I myself had an appointment with a physician this week, and it was all done by telemedicine using an application from Penn State Medical System, in which I called in and had a video call with my care provider and discussed the situation. While I'm not entirely sold on this myself as a primary means of care in places where physicians are not available, but where governments and private vendors can get data available and communication services, so that people use mobile telephony or they can use the internet to conduct this sort of care, it may be a useful function, at least to help triage or identify medical conditions so that local teams can get out and help provide care and certainly sort these things out for folks. Additionally, in Uganda, disappointing news for the Christian community, as Uganda bishops have canceled the 2020 Martyrs Day celebrations that were scheduled for Namugongo Shrine. The June 3rd Martyrs Day had not been canceled for many years. It's an almost year-long fundraising preparation that takes place and brings together almost a million pilgrims who come this year to the Diocese of Masaka for the celebrations. Now, the Masaka Diocese had raised over 300 million shillings, that's about $80,000, in preparation for the feast, which required a total of 950 million shillings, or $250,000, according to the Vatican News. Now, for folks who are unfamiliar with Martyrs' Day and wondering what it is, it's a public holiday in Uganda. The Ugandan martyrs are a group of 22 Catholic and 23 Anglican converts to Christianity in the historical kingdom of Buganda, which predated colonization by Europeans, the Buganda kingdom. Most of the converts were young men, and the new Christian converts abandoned traditional forms of worship, which led the king of the Buganda, Kabaka Mwanga II, to fear that the new religion and presence of the missionaries were severely eroding his authority in the kingdom. So he ordered the execution of the converts between 1885 and 1887. This decision unleashed the wave of persecutions against Christians in the kingdom. And this is celebrated as Martyrs' Day, a public holiday in Uganda to this day. It has grown in importance and interest in the past few decades after having been neglected for a long period of time with a smaller group of people celebrating it. But it's a rather huge event, and this year it will not be taking place. That's unfortunate for Ugandans. But in the interest of public health in the wake of the COVID-19 crisis, it's certainly understandable. Yet another event in which people will not be able to congregate together. This would be, unfortunately, a very, very fertile ground for this virus to attach itself to folks. So probably a prudent decision on part of the church. In other news in Uganda, this is from Halima Atumani, and this is on the 30th of April. This comes from Voice of America. She reports that a court in Uganda this week rejected bail for 19 members of the LGTB community who were arrested for gathering in public in violation of the coronavirus lockdown. Now, some of you may remember that last month there at a shelter for sexual minorities, a group of young men aged 19 to 32 were arrested. Of course, the community is saying that this is because they were targeted because of their sexual orientation. On March 29th, police arrested 23 members of an LGTB community shelter, the Children of the Sun Foundation, in the town of Gyengera, 10 kilometers southwest of Kampala. Four of the men were released on medical grounds, while the others were presented to court and remanded to prison. They have been in prison since then. The defendants were charged with conducting an act likely to cause the spread of an infectious disease. Now, that's an interesting statute, but apparently it's on the books. However, spokesmen and lawyers for these folks are saying that COVID-19 was used as an excuse to get them remanded to prison, and COVID-19 is still being used as an excuse not to bring them to court. However, Patrick Onyango, who's the deputy spokesman for the Kampala police, has said they were not being targeted because they're gay. It was the community that saw that these people were violating the presidential directives and informed police, and these were more than 10. They were 23 in number. Actually, Ugandan authorities have now outlawed any gathering of more than 5 people, so 23 people gathered. This does raise some questions, however. If they were in a shelter, was this not their abode, their residence? If they're staying in the shelter and not going around the community, what is the issue? Are we arresting people who live, 23 people in a house because that's their abode for a family of 23 or a group of 23 people who are in an institution? It is questionable. I have to wonder what is happening here. The 19 men will remain in jail until a court hearing on May 12th, unless the court releases them since then. I've seen no reports of them having been released. Of course, the issue of homosexuality and legislation directed against that community has been a big issue in Uganda, at least since 2014, late 2013, when the legislature passed an anti-homosexuality law, even though there was already statute on the books. This was a more draconian law, and when I lived in Uganda, it created quite a problem with the NGOs that were working for the U.S. government, as they were providing services for those who were affected by HIV, and the police targeted some folks that work for our NGO. It caused all sorts of problems. A huge diplomatic row between President Museveni and President Obama has both ratcheted up the rhetoric in advance of Uganda's national elections that were taking place a short time after that. Also in Uganda this week, more encouraging news as a Ugandan company, Quality Chemicals Limited, CIPLA, which is based in Luzira, has received approval from the South African Health Products Regulatory Authority to start supplying antiretroviral HIV drugs to South Africa. Quite an interesting development. Nevin Bradford, the Chief Executive Secretary Officer for the company, recently said 300,000 packs of antiretrovirals were shipped to South Africa as part of its Africa for Africa ambition. CIPLA is also in the final phases of gearing up to manufacture the antimalarial drug hydroxychloroquine. Those paying attention to news, this is the antimalarial that's proved quite effective for over 5 decades. I myself have taken this drug repeatedly in Africa with no ill effects, and fortunately, knock on wood, have yet ever to contract malaria by taking this drug or other antimalarials. This drug gained a great deal of attention initially when a French study released early in February indicated that it may have efficacy in the treatment for those in the early stages of COVID-19 infection. When President Donald Trump suggested that this might be a potential treatment for it, of course, the media lost their minds. And since then, many people have gone either way to discredit the drug, claiming it's dangerous and can only be taken under the care of a physician, including the Centers for Disease Control here in the United States. And that's simply not factually true. You simply need a prescription from a licensed physician, and then you can take the drug for fighting malaria and for a host of other things. CIPLA also exports antiretrovirals and other drugs to Kenya, Tanzania, Ethiopia, Malawi, Zimbabwe, Angola, Zambia, and Botswana. This comes from The Observer, which is Ugandan-based news service. So interesting to hear that news. All right, back to Southern Africa. Taking a look at Southern Africa, Namibia will be easing the nationwide lockdown restrictions beginning on Tuesday. So just a few days from now, at midnight on Monday, May 4th, turning to May 5th, they will be easing a number of restrictions as a consequence of a limited impact of COVID-19. So far, Namibia had seen, when this report was done on the 30th of April from Nyasha Nyaungwa, when she wrote this report from Reuters, there had been only 16 confirmed cases with no deaths in all of Namibia, a country of about 2.6 million people. The president in a televised speech said that from midnight Monday, they will be easing restrictions. People will be permitted to travel domestically, but they will be required to wear face masks at all times. Namibians can return to the country, re-enter Namibia, but they will be subject to screening and quarantine for 14 days on arrival. However, the borders will remain closed for all non-Namibians. So if you're not a Namibian citizen, you will not be able to enter Namibia during this period. Businesses and productive activities can reopen. Shopping malls, shops, and restaurants will continue to operate on a takeaway basis. So you can't sit down and eat, but you can take away. The buying and selling of liquor with more than 3% alcohol does, however, remain prohibited. So that will probably disappoint a lot of folks, unless they're teetotalers. Also in Namibia, in relationship to this development, the Education Ministry's Permanent Secretary, Sinet Steenkamp, announced that teachers will be returning to work on Tuesday, May 5th. So all staff members of the education ministry must report for duty on Tuesday. Principals, teachers, administrative staff, institution workers, and hostel staff are expected to physically report to their schools during the period of 6 to 11 May. All staff members must have reported to schools no later than 11 May. So you might be saying, well, that's excellent. That's really wonderful news to hear that the schools are reopening. Well, the schools aren't reopening. The faculty staff are returning to work in their places of work rather than doing telework. Steenkamp said that schools reopen on the 3rd of August with the start of the third quarter of the school year and all pupils returning to schools simultaneously. So there'll be no staggered return, according to this article from Tomieo Haidula. Moving a little bit further to the east in southern Africa, and we'll take a look at what's happening in Malawi, where interesting things are underway. The Minister of Finance, Economic Planning and Development, Joseph Mwanavika, has said that he wanted to thank the World Bank for its contributions to help Malawi. The World Bank has injected about $100 million into Malawi to help them fight COVID-19. This was initially a $7 million immediate funding that was released to Malawi, and since then $30 million has been made available from the Disaster Risk Management, Development Policy, and Financing. So this is helping. In addition to the World Bank funding that's coming to Malawi, the International Monetary Fund approved a disbursement under the Rapid Credit Facility equivalent to another $91 million to help Malawi meet urgent balance of payments needs. The minister said this is a timely intervention. Indeed, it is, and should be helpful for Malawi, which is suffering immensely from this COVID-19 crisis. Also in Malawi, the government has launched a cash transfer scheme to help the poor. Eligible households will receive 35,000 kwacha, which is about $40 monthly payment under a transfer program that will benefit about 1 million people and small businesses affected by the coronavirus, President Mutharika said on Tuesday. Eligible households receive up to $35,000 monthly payment matching the country's minimum wage through mobile cash transfer starting in May. Now, this does not set a date for when that will happen or how soon that will happen, but doubtless people who are not making any money at this point, have no income, will be looking forward to this at least small amount of money to help them. Now, the president said this will strengthen livelihoods. I'm not really sure how it strengthens a livelihood, as that refers to how people make money to live, and this is not tied to work. Additionally, in Malawi, the High Court temporarily halted the government's 21-day coronavirus lockdown pending judicial review this past week. Interesting development, the court's actually shutting down the national government's ability to impose a lockdown as they take a look at what is happening with the coronavirus and what the government's actions are. Are they in line with the Constitution? Are they legal? And do they meet the standards that the court says must be met? Waiting to hear a decision back on that. That is interesting. All right, so in South Africa, taking a look at that this week, a rather significant court case and a decision was reached this past week as the Solidarity Union and the civil rights group Afroforum filed a court case on Tuesday challenging the Tourism Relief Fund and a decision to use broad-based Black economic empowerment codes for consideration on whether people in the tourism industry could get money from this relief fund. The North Gauteng High Court ruled that the Department of Tourism's decision to consider empowerment codes as a criterion for assisting companies is not unlawful. The court was of the view that the criterion does not perpetuate unfair advantage for some candidates over others based on race, but rather has the effect of providing those candidates with a head start. Now, like you, I'm a bit confused. I imagine you're confused as well. How is it that someone is not getting an unfair advantage if they're given a head start? When we run in the Olympics, we don't give people a 10-meter lead for the 100-meter dash. We don't lower the bar for the high jump and then give people credit for a higher height. We don't add 3 meters to the length that people go on the long jump so that they can win. Giving someone a head start or an advantage is, in fact, an advantage, and it is also unfair and discriminatory. So this just falls in line with the broader issue of Black economic empowerment and discriminatory race-based legislation that the South African government uses to keep minority businesses from trading with the government. And in this case, it's particularly distressing to see in the midst of a Black Swan event, the coronavirus crisis, Wuhan coronavirus COVID-19, we see the government of South Africa discriminating against segments of its society. And they do this based on the concept that this helps Black South Africans. I'm not really sure how you can make that argument when the majority of businesses in the tourism industry that are minority-owned or white-owned, 2 out of 3 employees happen to be black Africans. So who exactly are you helping and who are you harming by denying funding for these companies? By giving some companies an advantage, you may cause the demise of others who don't have the resources to survive. So I really don't understand what the government is doing there. So as this took place, the Constitutional Court is the only option now for the plaintiffs, Solidarity and AfriForum, to take this up once again. So they're going to go before the Constitutional Court. Sir Dirk Herman, who is the CEO of Solidarity, said, "It is imperative that South Africa gets legal certainty on whether, in a state of disaster, the Constitution allows for discrimination based on race in order to qualify for relief. Solidarity is going to request access to the Constitutional Court. As the crisis is urgent, we believe the matter, too, is urgent." And I would agree with Mr. Herman. It is an urgent matter in the midst of this crisis. Solidarity argued the COVID-19 pandemic does not discriminate against its victims on the basis of race and that it is therefore immoral of the government to offer relief on these grounds. And I would agree with that. I see no reason to dispute what is being said there. Now, this comes about a month after the Department of Small Business Development Minister, Kumbudzo Ntshavheni, said that her department would not be discriminating, handing out this sort of assistance based on BEE codes. In fact, when the website first went up so that people could apply for these grants, which the equivalent of 50,000 Rand or about $2,741, so not a lot of money, but when these grants first went up and listed on the website, she came on and claimed that people were spreading fake news, claiming that there was BEE tied to the disbursement of funds. Of course, the problem with that is that the application that was on the website, the government website, included this question and specifically stated that those who are not BEE certified as a majority-owned business would not be able to get the funds and set criterion for it. So she claimed it was fake news, was being spread by people, that was simply information came from her website. So here we go forward a month later. That was in March. Now we're in April. We're actually seeing not only the Tourism Relief Fund being applied on a race basis, but we're seeing the North Gauteng court uphold the decision, ludicrously claiming that it is not discriminatory. It only gives a head start to majority-owned businesses. It's beyond comprehension what's happening here. And finally, on South Africa, I'd like to wrap up today's discussion talking about the passing of an icon of the liberation era. Mr. Dennis Goldberg passed away this week at the age of 87. He's famously the only white member of Mkhonto we Sizwe, or MK, the armed group of the African National Congress, who was tried at the Rivonia trials for terrorism against the state. That, of course, famously is also where Govan Mbeki and Nelson Mandela were also tried. Mr. Goldberg was given 4 life sentences, and he served 22 years in prison in Pretoria before he was released in 1985. He's one of the last remaining members who were tried in the 1960s for the Rivonia trials. On his passing this week, a very touching article by Chris Bishop from CNBC Africa, in which he relates some of his interactions with Mr. Goldberg later in his life. And so I'll read that now from the CNBC article. So Chris Bishop says, "I once asked Dennis Goldberg what he thought of one of his high-ranking former comrades taking 500,000 rand in bribes from a crook. 'What a cheapskate,' came back the reply, faster than the gunslinger's bullet. I expected a more pious reply. Not with Dennis. He sold out his job, his country, his beliefs, his politics, and his morals for $500,000. Dennis said that with a deadpan look on his face. Believe me, he was deadly serious and angry, but his expression dissolved into that famous smile of his that made you think we frail human beings all make mistakes. That was Dennis and his attitude in a nutshell. He was principled and far from enamored in later years with all that was going on in the government that he had fought to put in power. And he was never afraid to say so." So he was tried at the Rivonia trials alongside Walter Sisulu, Govan Mbeki, Ray Malaba, Andrew Malangeni, Ahmed Kathrada. Only Malangeni, who is 95 this June, turns 95, is still alive today. On Friday, President Cyril Ramaphosa announced that there would be a state of mourning for 3 days, the national flag of South Africa flying in half-mast from Friday, May 1st until Monday, May 4th. In recognition of his contributions to South Africa. Now, Mr. Bishop says in his article that Dennis Goldberg's humor was legendary, as was his compassion. He said that he once told Bishop that he was handed 3 life sentences but was given a bulk discount and only served 1. Yeah. On the other side of the coin, he said that he told him of the horror of lying in a cell, listening to condemned men screaming as warders led them to the gallows, to the execution. Now, it's wonderful that President Cyril Ramaphosa has recognized the passing of an icon of liberation struggle, Dennis Goldberg, for his contributions to South Africa and the liberation struggle, and also that they recognize him with 3 days of mourning. I would have preferred to see a week. That's kind of a normal standard. I don't know what the standard is in South Africa. Many countries, people usually get a week of mourning. But it is excellent that President Ramaphosa did recognize him, and people around the world are outpouring sympathy for his family and for the apartheid struggle and those who participate in it. President Ramaphosa also expressed his deep condolences at the passing of Goldberg and said, "At this time, we cannot say our goodbyes in person and in our numbers. May the silent prayers and gratitude of the people of South Africa carry his brave and patriotic soul to its final rest." Of course, what President Ramaphosa is referring to is that there is not going to be a state funeral, at least one with people attending, because of the restrictions, the lockdown under COVID-19. That's understandable. Ramaphosa continued by saying, "This is a sad moment for our nation and a moment for all of us to appreciate Dennis Goldberg's brave dedication to our struggle and his lifelong activism in the interest of and in the physical presence of poor and vulnerable communities around the country." Those are excellent words. Thank you, President Ramaphosa, for those wonderful things that you say about Dennis Goldberg, who played a significant role in bringing attention to South Africa and the apartheid struggle. But I would ask Ramaphosa, why is it that on Freedom Day, April 27th of 2020, he could not be bothered to mention Dennis Goldberg and his contributions to the liberation struggle? Not a single white South African was mentioned in his remarks on the 27th of April, Freedom Day, in which several times in his remarks he posed race against race, ethnic group against ethnic group, and framed the struggle in terms as if the only people who did anything were largely the ANC. Dennis Goldberg should have been recognized on Freedom Day by President Ramaphosa, and that was an oversight that should but not be neglected, and should be reminded of that. Nonetheless, his comments and the designation of days of mourning to recognize Dennis Goldberg are an excellent decision and should be commended. Ladies and gentlemen, that has been a little bit about the news of Africa for this week on All Things Africa. I hope that you enjoy this podcast. If you have any questions, feel free to leave a comment and get in touch with me, and I will be happy to address them. If there's content that you would like to see that goes beyond what we've shared here tonight, other countries you'd like to see covered on All Things Africa, feel free to let us know, and we'll see you here next time on All Things Africa.